All right, so we'll continue our study in Psalms. Our summary statement for Psalm 96. Psalm 96 calls the nations to sing a new song to the Lord for His reign and His righteous judgments. Go over that one more time. Psalm 96 calls the nations to sing a new song to the Lord for His reign and His righteous judgments. A simple outline for the psalm, two parts, verses 1 to 6, God above all gods. Verses 7 to 13, God reigns over the nations. So I'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 6, God above all gods. Verses 7 to 13, God reigns over the nations. All right, so let's go to our observations. Psalm 96 has no superscription, no heading. Now, Psalm 95 was attributed to David by the writer of Hebrews, and that psalm had very plain connections to 1 Chronicles chapter 16 on the occasion when they brought back the ark. And so Psalm 96 follows right after that psalm. Psalm 96 also has many connections. It has many connections to Psalm 95 and also many connections to 1 Chronicles chapter 16. In fact, if you look at 1 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 23 to 33, it is very similar actually to this psalm. They are very close to each other in their wordings. Now, Jewish tradition has attributed, I guess, Psalm 96 to David. Of course, that's true of pretty much all of the anonymous psalms, that they're attributed to David in Jewish tradition. But I do think here we have good reason to think that there's a Davidic authorship here. But it wouldn't be something we could be 100% confident about. But I do think there's good reason to think that it is a psalm that goes along with Psalm 95 that was written intentionally that way, and they certainly do fit together very well and fit that occasion very well as well. So Psalm 96 calls for singing repeatedly and even specifies the singing of a new song. But beyond that, there's no other musical direction, no tunes or anything like that, no selahs in the text. Now, there's no occasion given in the heading of the psalm. But again, the connections that we talked about with Psalm 95 and 1 Chronicles chapter 16 would make the occasion the return of the ark in David's day. Again, probably not something we could be 100% confident about, but it does seem very likely, especially given the linguistic and thematic connections between these passages and 1 Chronicles 16. To categorize Psalm 96, it is a praise psalm. And it cycles between calls to praise and reasons for praise, which we've seen this quite a bit in the Psalms. So you have a sort of a catalog of God's praiseworthy acts and attributes, reasons for praising and calls to praising. And so there is it sort of cycles between those throughout this psalm. It does have a number of minor elements to it that pretty much goes right along with Psalm 95 before it as well. It does have some creation elements to it, God being referred to as creator. We also have the realms of creation are seen as praising God. It's a kingship psalm. We have this phrase, the Lord reigns, which doesn't actually occur extremely often, but it does occur here in this psalm. So reference to His universal kingship. The psalm is also prophetic, and it is predictive. So The psalm looks forward to the future coming of the Lord, and that's how the psalm ends, with the Lord will come. Psalm 96, it does have those connections with the previous psalms in this group and in this book. So you go back to Psalm 90 up through Psalm 95, and it's got connections with all those psalms. Probably one absence would be we have no mention of Israel in this psalm. And so, therefore, we don't have any of the wilderness or the exile motifs that we've seen in the previous psalm. But that also makes sense because this psalm is addressed to the nations. It's not addressed to Israel like Psalm 95 was. So primarily in these psalms, what we've seen is that primary theme of God's kingship, Yahweh's supremacy over all, being declared in these psalms. And being declared in such a way that it is the answer to Psalm 89. So you remember Psalm 89 was their complete devastation. Jerusalem is destroyed. The crown and the throne of David are thrown down in the dust. The Davidic line has failed. Israel is exiled from their land. And so they end with that question, has God forsaken his covenant? Has God forsaken his promises? And so we are answering that in books 4 and 5 as we're heading toward the end of the Psalms. And in book 4, especially, the way the psalm begins is by all these references to God's universal kingship. And what we've already seen from that in the Psalms up to this point is that references to God's kingship typically are made so as to show that his Messiah is going to come. His anointed son king is going to be installed on Zion. Why? Because he rules over all. He rules over all heaven. He rules over all earth. And there's none that can stop him from fulfilling his plan and his word. So that theme continues in this psalm. The connections again to Psalm 95 are very close, and that with 1 Chronicles chapter 16 as well. There are also connections in this psalm with Psalm number 2. When you think about the Lord's coming in judgment with the call to the nations to bow before him before his wrath comes. And there's also a number of connections with this psalm and that are outside of the psalms with the prophecy of Isaiah. So if you look at Isaiah, the second half, and there's a clear division when you look at the book of Isaiah. First 39 chapters are obviously one section of that prophecy, and chapters 40 to 66 are another set of that section of that prophecy. And so if you look at that second section, you get a number of themes there that are echoed in Psalm 96. So you get the references to idolatry and the idolatry of the nations. That shows up in Isaiah 40, verses 18 to 31. Isaiah 41, verses 21 to 24, Isaiah 44, verses 6 to 8. You get references to the creation, and not just to the creation, but even to the redemption of the creation, the restoration of the creation. So that would be Isaiah 40, verse 22, Isaiah 42, verse 5, Isaiah 44, verse 24, Isaiah 45, verse 12, Isaiah 49, verse 13, Isaiah 55, 12. And then another theme that runs through that part of Isaiah as well has to do with the nations, both with judgment coming on the nations and the redemption of the nations, such that the nations are worshiping Yahweh and will be bringing their tribute into Jerusalem. So references there, Isaiah 45, verse 20, Isaiah 49, verse 7, Isaiah 56, verses 3 to 8, Isaiah chapter 60, verses 9 to 12 and 14 and 16. Isaiah chapter 66 and verse number 18. So a lot of those big themes and the eschatology that's sketched out, particularly in that second half of Isaiah, are reflected here in Psalm 96. Now, the poetic features of Psalm 96 are particularly interesting. So the first and most obvious as you read through is there's a lot of repetition. And some of it you might miss on first read just because translation variants. Sometimes the same Hebrew word will be translated three or four different ways. And which, when you try to dig into those things, Essentially, that's for the issue of readability. And so one problem, it makes it easier to read in a sense, or makes it more readable. But then on the other hand, it also makes the translation less obviously connected. So when the Hebrew has the same word or the Greek has the same word, often, and pretty much all the English translations do this. I think that started, it may have started back with Tyndale, wanting to vary the translation and using different words. And so in the same passage, you might have the same word repeated several times, and it might be translated three different ways. Well, that happens here in Psalm 96. But there's a lot of repetition. Again, it's not as obvious in the English, but there's a lot of repetition in Psalm 96. So, and sometimes it doesn't have to, poetic repetition doesn't necessarily have to be the same word. It can be a synonym or it can be a related term. So you get repetition of sing and song, that Yahweh, his name appears continually through the psalm. The earth and the world, nations and peoples, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Rejoice, judge. There's a lot of different terms and things that are repeated. So there's just a lot of repetition in this psalm. Now, another feature that, and as far as I can tell, I think this makes this psalm unique among the psalms. And I'm referring to it as a compositional irony, and that's probably not proper literary terms at all. But it's what made sense to me, because the psalm starts out by saying, "Sing unto the Lord a new song." And so one of the things that actually some of the commentaries that you may read on it, there's a little bit of confusion because it says sing a new song. And so there would be an anticipation. Well, this psalm is a new song composition. But that's actually not the case. This psalm, nearly every line of this psalm is repeated or it is found in other psalms. Almost every line, and they range from being an exact quote to being very, very similar. Now, as far as I know, there's no other psalm that there is repetition in the psalms, but I don't know of any other psalm where every line of the psalm, except, well, I guess maybe there would be, I forget which number it is, but one of those really short ones that is a repetition of an earlier, But as far as a psalm of this length being a mashup of all of these different lines that can be found all throughout the psalms, it does stand alone. So that's why I referred to it as a compositional irony, because it says sing a new song, but then really when you look at it, nothing is new. Every line is repeated somewhere, which makes this psalm, again, unique and quite interesting. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about why that is in a little bit. So we want to work our way through this psalm, 13 verses. And so I want to go ahead and read it. "Oh, sing unto the Lord a new song. Sing unto the Lord all the earth. Sing unto the Lord, bless his name. Show forth his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the heathen, his wonders among all people. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Give unto the Lord, O ye kindreds of the people, give unto the Lord glory and strength. Give unto the Lord glory, the glory due unto his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. Say among the heathen that the Lord reigneth. The world also shall be established, that it shall not be moved. He shall judge the people righteously. Let the heavens rejoice, and let the earth be glad. Let the sea roar, and the fullness thereof. Let the field be joyful, and all that is therein. Then shall all the trees of the wood rejoice before the Lord, for he cometh to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness, and the people with his truth." All right, so in verses 1 to 3, we have the opening call to praise. And each verse is a call to praise. It's a call to sing, a call to bless, a call to bring good news, a call to recount. And you see the word for show forth there in verse number 2, show forth his salvation from day to day. That word only occurs two other times in the Psalms. And in Psalm 40 and verse 9, it's translated preached. And in Psalm 68 and verse 11, it's translated published. It also occurs five times in Isaiah, and it's in the section of Isaiah that we talked about earlier. So Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 9, Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 27, Isaiah 52 and verse number 7, Isaiah chapter 60 and verse 6, Isaiah chapter 61 and verse number 1. All right, so the word means to bring good news, to bring glad tidings. And in fact, it is the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek word that we're so familiar with that is oftentimes translated as gospel. It is usually transliterated as evangelize, but it's translated as gospel or good news. And this is the Hebrew equivalent of that word. So preach the good news. Tell the good news of his salvation from day to day. And the substance of what is being sung about, what's being shown forth, and what's being declared, the substance of all of that, it's the Lord's salvation, and it's his wonders throughout the earth. His deliverance, his salvation, and his miraculous works throughout the earth. Now, the opening line of the psalm calls for singing a new song. And if we just read that, we might just assume, oh, okay, well, then this psalm is a new song. This is the new song. This is a new composition. And again, that's where that irony comes in, because it's not a new composition, and it's repeated from so many other psalms. Well, the issue is that we have to go through the psalms, go through the Bible to see what singing a new song is about. And it's not as much about a new composition in the sense that, you know what, we've sung that song 1,000 times. Let's sing something new. Let's sing something different. But it's singing of a new song that is a new occasion. It's a new occasion. So when you look at this phrase and the singing of a new song, it only occurs 9 times in the entire Bible. Doesn't happen that often. So you've got 6 times that it shows up in Psalms. That would be Psalms 33, verse 3, Psalm 40 and verse 3, here in Psalm 96, 1, later in Psalm 98, 1, in Psalm 144 and verse 9, and Psalm 149 and verse 1. It shows up one time in Isaiah, and of course it's in that second section of Isaiah. It's Isaiah 42, 10. And it shows up twice in the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 5 and verse number 9. Revelation chapter 14 and verse number 3. So those are the only 9 times in the entire Bible that the singing of a new song is spoken about. And when you study the context of every mention of singing a new song in the Bible, every time it is in reference to the Messiah and his kingdom coming to the earth. And Psalm 96 is no exception to that. So again, the singing of a new song is not about singing new words or writing a new song or about necessarily having some new experience. The singing of a new song is about a new occasion. So you could think of it like when, after the Last Supper, Jesus told his disciples that I will drink this new with you in my kingdom. So that's a new occasion. He's not going to drink of it with his disciples until that kingdom comes, and then he will drink it with them. Same way, this singing is not sung until the kingdom has come. So that's what the singing of a new song is about here, as well as in the other 8 times that it occurs in the Bible. So Isaiah 42:10, in fact, is a good place if you want to go back some time and just look at that chapter. Isaiah 42:10 is a good place to see what this singing of a new song is about. Because the new song is brought about by the coming of the Messiah in judgment. That new song is in the restored earth, the Messiah's kingdom, and it emphasizes praise covering all the earth. This new song, it's a new occasion when all things are made new. Now, the word for glory that is used here, and it's repeated a couple more times, that is the Hebrew term kavod. That's one of the words that we've pointed out as we've gone through the Psalms. It is a word for glory. It literally means weight. It is a word that typically refers, or it's typically associated with kingship, with reigning, with authority, with power. And we've seen it. Psalm 3 and verse 3 is where we started tracking that. Psalm 4 and verse 2, Psalm 7 and verse 5, Psalm 8 and verse 5, Psalm 16 and verse 9, and on and on and on. It's used a lot. And if you saw a chart of the usage of kavod in the Psalms, and you would look down through there and look at the Psalms that it was used in, you would start picking out pretty quickly, that's a messianic psalm. That's a messianic psalm. That's a messianic psalm. So, like, you know, Psalm 3 and Psalm 8, Psalm 16. I mean, they just stand out. You know, well, those are messianic psalms. And here's the use of this term kavod, and it is associated in some way with kingship. So, declaring the glory of God is to declare His reign. It is to declare His kingship. It is to declare His power and His authority. The terms or the phrase day to day, that's just a poetic expression for continually. Like this, there's going to be no end of this praise. In other words, now the words for heathen and people that you see right there in verse number 3, He declares His glory among the heathen and His wonders among the people. All right, now so this is some of what I was talking about that kind of gets a little bit lost in translation. The words heathen and people, they're introduced here and they're repeated throughout this psalm. Several times they occur in this psalm. And in both cases, the words in the Hebrew are plural. So you notice heathen and people. And they are plural in every occurrence in this psalm. So in other words, the words that are talking about is talking about not just individuals, but it's talking about people groups. That's what it's talking about. So the word for heathen is actually the word goyim, which means nation. Now, through usage, most of the time, goyim refers to non-Israelite nations, most of the time. And of course, it does here as well. Rarely, but there are a few times when Israel is called a goy, because the word itself literally just means a nation. It is a people group, a political, a social, political, cultural group of people. And then we have the other word that is used that's translated people, and that is amim. And amim, again, it's plural, and really it would be better translated peoples, because it's not just people as in a collection of individuals, but it's peoples in terms of people groups or nations. So the two most common words for nations in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, are goyim and amim. And both of those are used here. And again, the reference here is to non-Israelite nations. And so anytime you see heathen or people, those are nations that are being referred to. So Psalm 96 then calls the nations to praise Yahweh. Now, if you remember from Psalm 95, Psalm 95 called Israel to praise Yahweh. So again, you can see how both of these psalms complement each other. They sort of work together. So Psalm 95 calls Israel to praise Yahweh and looks to this future time. And Psalm 96 now calls the nations to praise Yahweh and looks to this future time as well. So verses 4 to 6 then give our first set of reasons for praising Yahweh. And there's a focus here on the supremacy of God and His reign. So He is above all gods. And again, that's not a real common reference. You do find it in 1 Chronicles chapter 16, but it's not a real common reference in the Bible. Now, the word for idols that is used here is not the more usual word for an idol. But it's even more a completely worthless thing that is being spoken of. And that's the reference that's being made to the gods of the nations. They're just completely worthless things. They're chunks of wood. They're pieces of stone. They are metal that has been melted down and molded and formed into some sort of shape. They're less than nothing. So God, though, Yahweh, he's the creator. All the attributes of royalty and deity belong to him. And this is what the nations are being called to acknowledge. Verses 4 to 5 in particular echo Psalm 95 and verse number 3. Then we get the second call to praise in verses 7 to 9. And verses 7 and 8 in particular are very, very close to Psalm 29 verses 1 and 2. And as we said, we could actually, you know, trace through and trace a lot of these lines to other psalms. We get this use of peoples and nations, but we do get an interesting use here that's not repeated, but it is used in verse number 7, kindreds of the people. And again, that's the plural amim. It is kindreds of the peoples or families. So what's interesting about that usage is all the families of the peoples, all the families of the nations. That is the same word that is used in the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12 and verse number 3, when God said that through Abraham he would bless all the families of the earth, all the kindreds of the earth. These kindreds would be smaller groups, tribes or clans or family groups within these nations. And again, the same word. So he promised to bless all the families of the earth through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the nation that comes from them, which is the nation of Israel. So in other words, this psalm is looking forward to the fulfillment of that promise to Abraham in the age to come. So in this psalm, we're actually seeing all the families of the earth being blessed through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and being blessed through Israel. So the nations are called to praise, they're called to worship Yahweh, but they're also called to bring their tribute, to bring their offerings before Him, before the Lord. And this call goes out to all of the earth. Then we look at verses 10 to 13 and we get these concluding reasons to praise. So we're told there in verse 10 that the Lord reigns. The Lord reigns. Stated in Psalm 93 in verse number 1. Again, it's not a real common reference, but it does occur here, particularly in this grouping of psalms. But notice here that there are two results of Yahweh's universal reign. And I know sometimes it can get maybe confusing to think about. And I probably don't help that, because sometimes I say universal and I mean one thing, and sometimes I say universal and I mean something else. But what we're talking about here in the universal reign, the universal kingship of Yahweh, we are talking about His rule over the universe. We're talking about His throne that was established from everlasting, His eternal throne over all of His creation, over this entire universe. We're talking about that universal reign. Now, when we talk about the kingdom, we're talking about the kingdom come to the earth. And the kingdom over the earth is what we refer to as a mediatorial reign. It is a reign that is under the universal reign of God. But sometimes we talk about that kingdom being universal because it covers the whole earth. So then universal is not really a very good term. And I'm guilty of doing that. And so hopefully that's not causing confusion. So the psalmist is talking about this universal reign of God. That's His throne in the heavens. That's His throne in the heavens. That's where Jesus Christ is right now, seated at the right hand of God, participating in His universal reign over this entire creation. But He's going to come to the earth one day to reign from the throne of David over the nation of Israel and through them over the entire earth. All right, so there is a coming kingdom that is going to be on this earth with the king, on the Davidic king, on David's throne. So when this statement is that the Lord reigneth, Yahweh reigneth, it's referring to that universal reign. And there's two results of that reign that are spoken of here in this psalm. Number one, the earth will be restored. Notice the descriptions. The earth, it says, the world shall be established that it shall not be moved. And then he starts talking about let the heavens, let the skies rejoice. Let the earth, let the land be glad. Let the seas roar and all that are in them. Let them rejoice, make a joyful noise. Let the field be joyful. Let all that's in the fields be joyful. Let all the trees of the wood rejoice before the Lord. So what we're looking at there is a restoration of the earth. The earth is not as Paul described it in Romans chapter number 8, and I think it's verses 19 to 25 maybe in there. He describes the earth and all of the creation as groaning, as being in travail, as being in pain, as being in an upheaval, but waiting for that restoration to come. So this is the restoration that is being referred to. So his coming in judgment will be a shaking of the earth. It's referred to as a shaking of the earth in Psalm 60 and verse 2 and in Psalm 82 and verse 5, as well as in some of the prophets. And so when you see that line that the earth will be established, that it shall not be moved, well, that's the reversing of that. So his coming in judgment shakes the earth, but his coming also results in the earth being established. And that word for established actually, it has the idea of restored. It has the idea of repaired, of being reformed. So the earth will be established. It'll be shaken with his coming in judgment. But the result of that will be that it will be restored. And that's just another way of talking about the curse being reversed, the curse being removed from the earth and the earth being restored so that all the aspects of the natural creation are brought into a harmonious balance and not the chaos and the enmity that we see as a result of the curse. That's the first result. The second result of God's universal reign is that his king will come to the earth. His king will come to the earth and he will judge the nations in righteousness. That's what is referred to there. So what judging the nations in righteousness means is that he will destroy the wicked and he will plant the righteous. And we could go right back to Psalm 1 and 2 to see those things. The wicked will be blown away by the wind of judgment, just like the chaff is. The righteous will be planted like trees by the rivers of water. Then the imagery in Psalm 2 shifts, that he comes for judgment with a rod of iron, and he's going to break the wicked into tiny little pieces like just so much clay pots and a rod of iron would do, and he's going to restore justice. All right, so what we're seeing is the result of Yahweh's universal reign is that in the future, the earth is going to be restored with the curse removed. And justice is going to prevail so that man and all creation will live in a peaceful, harmonious balance and will praise the Lord. So the restoration of the earth means that curse is reversed, the justice reigns over the earth. And so then let the created world rejoice in that restoration. And that's what we're seeing. The skies are rejoicing, the land, the seas, all that are in the seas, the fields, and all that are in the fields are rejoicing, and all the nations are rejoicing. And so these echo also from places like Psalm 65 and verse 13, Psalm 89 and verse number 12, as well as Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 12, and other places as well. And so then we end with verse 13 and this concluding prophecy of the Lord's future coming. He's coming. That's what they say. He's coming. The Lord is coming. Yahweh is coming. He's coming to the earth. He's coming to judge the earth. He's coming to judge the world with righteousness. He's coming to judge the peoples, the nations with his truth. So he's coming. He's coming to rule with righteousness. And again, Psalm 2 and verse 9 refers to that as his rule with a rod of iron. And that's also repeated in the prophets. It's even repeated in the New Testament as well, that he will rule with a rod of iron. What does that mean? That means that he will establish his righteous rule over all the nations. And that also means that he's going to sit on a throne on this earth. He's going to rule over this earth such that the nations will be ruled with a rod of iron. Now, what does that tell us? Well, that tells us that this is an intermediate kingdom. Why? Because in the eternal ages, there will be no sin. There will be no rod of iron in the eternal ages. But in his millennial kingdom, he will punish sin immediately. And he will punish it with, again, a rod of iron. So, and that's, we can find references about that where the nations that do not come up to bring their tribute to the Lord, they do not come up to Jerusalem in his kingdom, they will be punished, it says, and they will be punished swiftly. He will rule with a rod of iron so that justice will prevail over this earth for, according to Revelation 20, 1,000 years. All right, so interpretation. Of course, I've already done quite a bit of interpretation there, but Psalm 96 obviously teaches, again, the sovereign supremacy of God, God's universal kingship, his rule over all creation. And this psalm expresses his rule over the realms of the natural creation, the skies, the seas, the land, the fields, the trees, and all of the life creation within those realms, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, the beasts of the field, and so on. But he also reigns over all other gods and all that are, we should say, called gods, because they are nothing and less than nothing, even as this psalm points out. And he also reigns over all the nations of the earth. Remember places like Daniel chapter number 4, that even though Nebuchadnezzar was given this dream and he is told, you're the head of gold. In other words, this dream meant that the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of Israel meant that the age of the nations began, which age we are still in. Now, sometimes you're probably more familiar with the language, the times of the Gentiles. But again, it's the same issue there. It's the ethnos or the ethne in the Greek. It is nations. It's not just individual people that are non-Jews. It's nations. It's age of the nations. That's the age that we are in. And God reigns over all the nations. So just like he said that to Nebuchadnezzar, he was brought out into the field to live as a beast until he understood that God reigns. And he raises up kings and he takes kings down as it pleases him to do. And there's not a man on earth and there's not a spirit being under the earth or in the heavens that can stop him or even call him to question and account for what he is doing. So God reigns over the nations of the earth. So that's this message of the sovereign supremacy. That's why that God's universal reign is being appealed to. Because God has a plan. God had made promises that reveals his plan. And he's going to carry that plan out. And there's none that can thwart him. And we are all answerable to him. So the messianic hope in Psalm 96 is obviously seen through the prophecy of the Lord's coming. This coming is what we refer to as the second coming, or to the return of Jesus Christ to the earth to destroy his enemies and to establish his kingdom. You have to remember, of course, in the Old Testament, the fact that there are two comings of Christ is just not always clear. And in fact, it sometimes things that were prophecies that were related to his first coming are said in the very same sentence with things that are prophesied will be fulfilled in his second coming. And so it is a little harder to distinguish that in the Old Testament. Of course, now, you know, we have the benefit of being able to look back. So this coming of the Lord that's spoken of, this is his coming in judgment. This is his coming to restore the earth. This is his coming to rule over the nations with a rod of iron. That is his second coming. That is his premillennial second coming to the earth. He brings justice to the earth. He reigns in righteousness over the earth. The earth is restored. The curse is lifted. The whole creation rejoices. And the nations enter into the gates with offering and with worship. So this is a description of that premillennial coming of Jesus Christ to the earth as described in various ways. And here's several references. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 to 5. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 to 7. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 to 4. Isaiah chapter 19, verses 24 to 25. Isaiah chapter 60, verses 3 to 5. Those are references to that future time that have primarily those same elements as what we're seeing here in Psalm 96. Zechariah chapter 2, verse 11. Zechariah chapter 14. Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 10. With his following, his coming during Revelation 19. And this is also seen in Psalm 72 and verses 8 to 16. All right, application. I have three of these. Number one, understanding Psalm 96 helps us understand the complete gospel. And so what I mean by that is that the gospel is not only about just personal individual salvation. It certainly is about that. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm saying it's not only about that. The gospel is actually about the redemption of creation itself and the nations of the earth. There is a bigger picture there. Now, the promise is to everyone, every individual who believes, understand that. But we see a bigger picture of that gospel. And even again, Psalm 96, using that word in the Old Testament, that's the equivalent of gospel in the New Testament. So the point is that the gospel is more than just a way out of hell. Maybe you've even heard it. I've heard it presented that way sometimes, sort of like an insurance card, just sort of a way to get out of hell. But it's actually much more than that. There's much more involved. It's the creation of, or rather, it's the redemption of the creation and the restoration of the creation, as well as the redemption of human souls and human lives. So it does help us to understand a fuller picture of a complete gospel. In other words, it's going somewhere. It's not just, you know, here's an escape from punishment, but it's going somewhere. Number two, understanding Psalm 96 helps us understand that the worship of God is worshiping Him for who He is, who He has revealed Himself to be. So the mention of judgment, for instance, it might seem out of place. You can read Psalm 96 and it sounds like such an upbeat, such a joyful, such a rejoicing psalm. And all these the trees of the woods are rejoicing, and the fields and all of these, it seems so upbeat, and then we get this mention of judgment. Well, we are not to praise only what we like about God. We're not to praise only what we're willing to accept about God. We're not to called to praise only what we would like Him to be. We're called to praise Him, who He is, who He's revealed Himself to be. His glory, His holiness, His wrath, His mercy, all of these things. And we see that in this particular psalm. And number three, understanding Psalm 96 also helps us understand there is a future. There is a future that we're all moving toward. We and everyone else on this earth are heading, and even the earth itself, we are heading toward something. And so Psalm 2 talks about some of those same things and then calls the nations to be wise and to submit to the Son. And so that's what Psalm 96 would call us to as well, recognizing that there is a future. So be wise. Submit to the Son. Bow to Him. Bow and confess Him as Lord and Savior now. There is a future, and a glorious future for those that trust in Him. All right, that's Psalm 96. Any questions on anything we talked about here tonight?
Okay. Verse 10, the same way that the Lord ran, the world also shall be established. Now, is that talking about the same exact time frame? The world being established when?
It shall be established that it shall not be moved. So, again, that word for established has the idea of it being restored or it being repaired. And it also comes out in the idea of it not being moved. So it is talking about, that's That's the result of his coming. So he comes in judgment, and his coming also brings this restoration that is talked about. So you can see that it's prophecy as well. You know, it shall be. This shall happen. So the psalm is the singing of a new song. So it's almost like it's projecting to that day. And this word is going to go over all the earth, because the knowledge of the Lord is going to cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. You know, so it's sort of the same way that Psalm 95 was. Does that? I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
Well, the Lord reigneth. That's talking about the Messiah on the throne of his father David, or is that talking about the universal reign of Yahweh over creation?
Well, the universal reign, I do believe is the primary reference there, and again, that phrase doesn't appear very often, and when you see it appearing, it is talking about his universal reign, but it's his universal reign that facilitates all of this, if that makes sense. Like that's the reason the praise is going to cover the earth, and the knowledge of the Lord is going to cover the earth, and why the Lord's going to come in judgment, and the earth's going to be restored, and all of that. So I do believe the primary reference is to his universal reign that's just eternal. I mean, it's everlasting in both directions, if you want to think of it that way. But his reign is going to be acknowledged on the earth when his son comes and reigns. So, that's it. Makes sense? Okay.